Hello and welcome to this interview that is part of the series that is all about empowering a League of Extraordinary Mothers about the power of food. Today's interview is with Professor Tim Noakes. I had a great deal of trouble condensing Professor Noakes's bio into something short, but here's what I've come up with. As a professor of exercise and sports science, Professor Noakes has published more than 750 books and articles. With a keen interest in nutrition, Professor Noakes came across research which denounced current international dietary guidelines as fallacy, and so started on a journey of researching the effects of carbohydrates, proteins and fats on the human body. His research convinced him that high fat, low carb is the healthiest option. A finding, Professor Noakes, that landed you in a great deal of hot water with a court case that lasted about 4 years. And we celebrated your not guilty verdict of that just in June of this year. So congratulations and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for the congratulations, and it's a pleasure and a privilege to be on your show. Thanks, Edwina.
Thank you. Look, I think for all of us mums, getting our heads around a very different way of looking at food. We all grew up with the food pyramid, and we've had some changes to that here in Australia, but there's so many differing ideas and differing opinions and absolute seeming experts that have so many conflicting ideas on what makes up a healthy diet. How do we start to wade through some of this? And, you know, can you give us some guidance, please?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question. I think what you have to realize that the information we've been given is driven by industry. It's not driven by hard science.
Yep.
And you have to be very, very suspicious of all the evidence that you've been given, point one. And point two, you have to look around you and you see, are people healthier today than they were 50 years ago? Wow. And the answer is no, we're in real trouble.
Yeah.
When I matriculated in 1966, everyone in my class except one guy was lean, and all the girls in the community were lean.
Yeah.
And we thought this guy had cancer because it was so unusual for a young man to be obese.
Yeah.
And he was literally the only one.
Yeah.
Today, when I go and lecture at high schools in less privileged communities,
yeah,
obesity is epidemic. And these are girls of 16, 17, 18, and it's really frightening. And then you go down to the local, anywhere in the public, and you'll see, again, this wide range of obesity. And it's really frustrating because we really do know what causes it.
Yeah.
And what's caused it is a food industry that has to increase their sales 20% each year. And so they have to get you to eat more food. And they do that by selling you highly addictive foods. They know exactly how to get humans to eat more food.
Yeah.
That's the reality, and it's a global conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy. This is business.
Yep.
And so they know how to control what science is being reported. They know how to control the key opinion leaders.
Yep.
So only a week ago, we had this dreadful paper came out from Harvard saying low carbohydrate diet will kill you, and it's the worst paper I think I've ever read in my life. Because first, it's not low carbs, and secondly, they didn't measure mortality, and they didn't show that they couldn't prove causation that it was a low carbohydrate diet, because the people who were dying had many other factors as well.
Yeah.
So it was junk science. The industry is now so brazen, and I use the word brazen, that they are getting this stuff published from the scientists they support. They're not even worrying anymore about the quality of the science.
Yeah.
In the past, they said that we supporting the low-carb diet have got no science, and our science is wrong. Now they've realized our science is absolutely robust.
Mm.
So now they're flooding the market with this junk science, and the public is taking it in. So the first point is we've been brainwashed, and we have to just look around and say, okay, what we've been doing for the last 50 years isn't working. Maybe it's time to change and do something else.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's carbohydrate is the center of the storm, isn't it? That's the that's what's causing all the problems, because we've grown up so heavily reliant on a very carbohydrate heavy diet, and the whole low fat movement, which, you know, is another part of this picture. And then once they took the fat out of everything, nothing had any flavor. So then they added in all the sugar. And so they're three areas that are probably key in this whole picture. Does that?
Yeah, I think so. And then of course the cereals and grain industry has, which is the industry that has grown dramatically in the last 30 years. Yeah. And the guidelines were specifically designed to promote the sale of grains from the United States to the rest of the world. And that's essentially what happened. And unfortunately, in South Africa and Australia, we followed these guidelines because we speak English. If we didn't speak English, we wouldn't have followed the guidelines. And people like France and Germany and Switzerland, who didn't follow the guidelines, haven't had the same problems that we've had. So, and again, it's the sort of the colonial opinion, you know, that America knows best. And so we'll follow what they do. And their scientists are the best. And we're all trying to be like them. And I think that's part of the reason why we adopted them without any thought on the matter.
Yeah. So trying to get our heads around what makes up a meal, what makes up a plate now, if we're not, first up, can we talk a little bit about carbohydrate? And we're not trying to cut out carbohydrates altogether and grain altogether. Is that your take on things?
Yeah, indeed. We know one of the most important slides I show is carbohydrates, protein, and fats. And I say, well, what do you use carbohydrates for? What's protein for and what's fats for? And protein has a long list of about 10 things in the body that for which protein is essential. Fats probably 15, a list of 15 essentials. And carbohydrate has one.
Energy.
That's energy. And that's it.
Yep.
Nothing else.
Yep.
And that's point one. And then point two, I said that we have no requirement for endogenous, i.e. ingested carbohydrate, because we've got this fabulous organ, the liver, which generates all the carbohydrate we need, and it uses fat and protein to produce the carbohydrate. Mm-hmm. And that can provide more than enough glucose for the body's requirements. So we have zero requirement for carbohydrate. And if you go back historically, let's go back 100 years, carbohydrate intakes were still low.
Yeah.
They were probably 25, 30% of the diet.
Right.
And even in America in 1964, 38% of the diet was carbohydrate and 45% was fat. So fat was the more dominant than carbohydrate. And we've changed that. And as we've changed that and increased the carbohydrate intake progressively, we become fatter.
Yeah.
And we're not saying go back to zero carbohydrate. We're just saying go back to 20 or 30% for the majority of people. So that's the problem. It's a nutrient we do not need. We don't need to eat any of it.
Mm.
We can eat it. And the reasons why we eat it, because we have to get in enough calories, and we can't eat too much protein because that's toxic. So we have to have a little bit of carbohydrate and plenty of fat. And if you don't have a lot of fat in the diet, then you have to substitute some of the energy with carbohydrate. In other words, you can't use protein to substitute. So that's the biology.
Yeah.
And once you understand the biology, you'll have to ask the question, why so much carbohydrate?
Mm.
And then the second point is that every time you eat carbohydrate, you secrete insulin in high concentrations. And that's the real problem.
Yeah.
So as a biologist, for me, it's obvious. And when I try to take people, I said, let's not worry about the epidemiology and the history and so on. Let's just look at the simple biology.
Yeah.
Every time you take carbohydrates, you increase your insulin and you stop burning fat.
Yeah.
And you become a carbohydrate-dependent animal.
Yeah.
And as you take in the glucose, and particularly if it's refined carbohydrates, you secrete hormones that make you hungry.
Mm.
And within 3 hours, you're hungry again. And the biology is simple.
Mm.
And we don't have to go any further than just look at the biology, and we can explain everything has happened.
Yeah. The simpler we can make it, the better it is for all of us.
Yeah, exactly.
So you talk about 20 or 30% of carbohydrate. What does that look like in a daily intake of food? One or two servings of carbohydrate? Can we cut it down and make it even more simple? Like, what does that relate to?
Yeah, that might be... So I think that humans can eat between 25 and 200 grams of carbohydrate.
Okay.
So if you took a 50 gram portion, which might be two slices of bread, or it might be two fruit samples, that you can only have four of those a day if you're eating 200 grams of carbohydrate. If, like me, you've got type 2 diabetes and you're eating 25 grams, it's essentially the only carbohydrate will come from vegetables, and most of them just leafy vegetables. That's the only place where I get carbohydrate from.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I think people don't understand how much carbohydrate is in the diet. And it's very easy to get your 50 to 100 grams of carbohydrate without even thinking about it.
Mm. Yeah.
I think the problem is that humans didn't evolve to count calories. We didn't evolve to work out the nutrient portioning. Mm. We were designed to eat food. that's it. And our body will tell you if you've had enough carb, protein, and enough fat. And you just got to follow that. But once you eat a high carbohydrate diet, that gets all confused.
Yeah.
And you're never getting in enough fat to really satiate you, so you can continue to eat. If you're not eating animal produce, you're eating a nutrient-poor diet, so that therefore you've got to eat more of it to try and get the nutrients in.
Yeah.
So we don't talk about portion sizes or counting fat grams or calories or whatever. And we just say, eat healthy foods, and just your body will tell you what to eat.
Yeah.
And we've been doing that for millions and millions and millions of years, as all creatures on the earth have been doing.
Yeah.
And it's only since the 1960s, when we started eating processed food, that we needed dietitians to give us these long calculations about what we should eat.
Yeah.
And that simply, it just doesn't follow biological rules at all.
Just keeps us very busy concentrating on something that should really just be coming pretty naturally. Yeah. But I think there is going to be a big transition phase for many, many people, many mums, and, you know, trying to feed their families and so on, where they're scratching their heads going, okay, well, if I haven't got a big bowl of pasta to fill everybody up with a bit of sauce to go on it, what do we make the plate look like? And especially, you know, when we start talking about eating fat, when so many of us have grown up with avoiding fat at all costs. I've got my dog that's just going to decide to go have a nutty down here. Excuse the noise. he thinks it's time for a walk. So if we're now adding fat into our diet, what does that look like?
Good. So, you know, I think good nutrition begins with breakfast, and you have to eat a high fat, high protein breakfast to satiation.
Yep.
By the way, we wrote the book, Raising Superheroes, which is, in my view, the best book on nutrition for children and young adolescents that I've ever read.
Yeah.
We really put an enormous amount of effort into it.
Yeah.
And it gives all the different options, and also what to feed a child when they go to school, what to put in their lunchbox and so on. Mm-hmm. So that, I'd encourage people to read that book. I think it's called Superfoods for Superhero Children or something, but it's on Amazon, and it's a magnificent book. And I don't often say that about our books, but that it didn't sell as well as other books I've written, but it's one of my favorites. Sorry. So the problem we have is that people eat too frequently, and children eat too frequently, and they eat too many foods away from home. Yep. And you need to encourage them to eat food at home, which is cooked by, prepared by the mother. Yep. And so you've got to start with a breakfast that's got lots of fat and lots of protein, which is eggs and bacon and sausages and cheese and avocado and salmon, those sorts of things,
yep.
Or as to what you can afford. And to get away from the cereals and grains, because, and you want the child to eat so much for breakfast that they don't want to eat again until they get home in the afternoon. And then you've solved the problem.
Yeah.
Because then they can come home and you can give them a second meal, which is, again, a high protein, high fat meal, meat, fish, dairy, whatever. But keeping away from snacking is a complete disaster, because every time you snack, you secrete glucose, your glucose rises, your insulin rises, and you convert from being a fat burner to a carbohydrate burner. And we want everyone to grow up burning fat.
Yep.
You know, there are some Australian scientists who don't like me. And one of them is a lady called Louise Burke. She advises the Australian Institute of Sport, and she's very high carbs and low fat. She did a wonderful study recently on fat adaptation in elite athletes.
Yep.
And the thing she found hasn't been reported. No one noticed it. So she took these elite athletes and she raced them over 25 kilometers, race walking. Yeah. And very cleverly, they measured what they were burning when they were carbohydrate on the high carbohydrate diet or on a high fat diet. Yeah. When they were on the high carbohydrate diet, they were burning carbohydrate at 4 or 5 grams a minute. That's a lot. When they converted to the high fat diet within 3 weeks at race pace, they were burning less than a gram a minute. They were hardly burning any carbohydrate. They were getting all the energy from fat. Now, these are world-class elite athletes. And what that tells you is that's the way we design. How can you convert in 3 weeks from being a massive carbohydrate burner to being a massive fat burner? You've got to tool up all your enzymes in your mitochondria and your body. And you can do it in 3 weeks if you're an elite athlete and completely, almost completely stop burning carbohydrate. That tells you that the natural state of humans is to burn fat for energy. And again, remember, these people were racing.
Yeah.
And they could get all the energy they needed during the race from fats, not from carbohydrate. And 99.9% of recreational athletes can just burn fat and they'll do everything they want to do.
Yeah.
And that's the message we have to get out. There was a lovely video yesterday on the winner of the New York Marathon last year, a female of 37 years old. And they were asking her, said, tell me, why explains your longevity? She said, it's my high fat diet. What? A high fat diet at 37 and you won the New York City Marathon? How's that possible? That's the future.
Yeah. You've warmed my heart a little with the talking about children's breakfast and then not eating when they get home. I've struggled with this because my children stopped eating at school because they got sick of people saying that their food looked weird, you know, carrot sticks and hummus dip, and you know, it didn't come out of a packet, and they've struggled with that, and so they stopped eating at school. So just to give mums an idea, breakfast in our house is a couple of eggs each, scrambled, maybe with some feta cheese, coconut milk, avocado, and then a big salad with a dressing, olive oil and balsamic vinegar dressing, and you know, getting in that protein and fat, and they last until they get home after school. That's what we've done out of necessity, but it's nice to hear that I was actually doing the right thing. We are always after that confirmation that we've got something.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the first question I ask anyone when they say, I want to lose weight. So what are you eating for breakfast?
Yeah.
And if they're eating a high carbohydrate breakfast, it's hopeless. You can't do anything until they convert away from that.
Yeah.
So it's the basis on which it determines everything. If you're going to eat carbohydrates for breakfast, in 3 hours' time, you're going to be hungry and you're going to have to eat. And what are you going to eat if you're at school or at the work? You're going to eat carbohydrates because that's what's provided by the tuck shop, etc.
Yeah. So a big part of this series is helping mums with energy. And you've certainly touched on it already, but can we just put the spotlight there for a minute? And, you know, so many mums, in fact, I hardly know anyone that doesn't complain of exhaustion and tiredness. And so is this fitting in with the picture of relying on carbs rather than fat? Is that your...
Yeah. I think so. And you know, when you're eating a lot of carbs, you're probably eating a lot of sugar and you've probably got a mild sugar addiction. Mm. And so it's like a drug that you run out of the drug 3 hours later, you've got to have another fix. And that's what I think the problem is. You know, I've been doing this diet now for nearly 8 years. And obviously, as you said, I'm quite well known for it. And a lot of people write to me and everyone says, I cannot believe the energy I've got.
Yeah.
And that's... whatever it is, it's one of the most remarkable changes that you get. You get away from all this fatigue and this brain fog, and you start to feel just so much better. Mm. We can't explain it because we don't understand what's going wrong. But all I know is that the high carbohydrate diet just makes you tired and fatigued.
Yeah.
And whatever the mechanism is, if it's just sugar or if it's carbohydrates, you really have to experience it to realize that you don't have to be tired all the day.
Mm.
And that burning the fat is just so beneficial. Mm. And where it's working, I don't know. It's working in the brain somewhere, we don't know yet. But and because we focus so much, oh, you mustn't have a heart attack and so on, we forget actually you must live each day. That's what's important. And you've got to eat more energy each day. Well, that's all you need.
Yeah. I was vegetarian for about 20 years, actually after I finished studying naturopathy, and I thought it was the best way to go. But one thing I noticed, you know, aside from energy and weight and so on, is moods. And I was a cranky woman. and that is part of that picture as well, is that the effect on our mood.
Yeah. We call it hangry, for people are eating lots of carbs. They're hungry and they're angry all the time.
I used to think of myself like the banshee, come about 3 or 4 o'clock. It was just like everything, nothing would go right.
Yeah. And it's funny that it seems to be animal protein that takes away those mood swings. But those are slightly different. But the hangry is that you eat carbohydrates, you spike your glucose, and then sometime 3 hours later it drops.
Yeah.
And now it becomes low and you get angry again. That may be a simplistic explanation, but the word hangry is very clear.
It works. So I guess another part of that is, you know, we've grown up with, just to bust a few more myths, we've grown up with this idea that we need to eat, you know, 4 or 5 times a day, if not more, and that, you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner and snacks in between and then something before we go to bed. And now we're looking at, you know, a great big movement that's talking about intermittent fasting and, you know, much less food in the day. Can you give us some guidance around that, please?
So when I converted to the low carb diet, yeah, I just thought it's low carb, it's fine. And then the fasting, intermittent fasting, I think became popular about 3 or 4 years ago, and I quickly adopted it, and it's definitely very beneficial.
Yeah.
And so what I do is I will eat a meal at 8 o'clock in the evening, and then not eat. I usually don't eat breakfast actually until I might have a meal at about 12 o'clock. And that's my fasting period. And that's the easiest way to do it. Is just don't eat between dinner and the next morning. Of course, it's difficult for your children. But you don't want children to intermittent fast. We're talking about people who've got obesity, metabolic issues. That's where, and they want to control their weight. That's where it's really very beneficial. And I think that what you do is by delaying the eating, you reduce your insulin levels even further.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do. We want a diet that keeps insulin levels as low as possible for as long as possible. And so that the periods between meals must be as long as possible. And I found that I don't usually go to eat fast for 24 hours. I don't see the reason need for it. But if you're fasting for between 12 to 18 hours a day and just only eating in that other window, that seems to be very, very helpful. Again, I think it's the sicker you are and the more insulin resistant you are, the more beneficial intermittent fasting is.
Yeah.
So I would really prescribe it for people who their weight is stuck and they want to lose more weight, or they have a metabolic condition.
Yeah.
But it's very clear that's how humans evolved. We were fasters. We didn't catch animals every 5 minutes and store the stuff in the fridge. We would catch the animals, eat them, and then we'd fast for, I don't know, 3-4 days maybe, before we'd start eating again and catch another animal. So that is our biology is designed for fasting. It's this eating every 4 hours is simply because it's an addiction.
Yeah.
And I tell people, if you're eating every 3 hours, you've got a food addiction and you've got to address it.
Yeah.
And the way you address it is by getting rid of the processed foods and the carbohydrates.
Mm. Yeah, that food addiction is another big topic, isn't it?
Yeah.
So for adults, you're saying like eating twice a day, really?
Oh, I can't see any reason to eat 3 times a day. That doesn't make sense.
Mm.
So that you would have, in the case we were talking about, I know it's confusing because we're talking about breakfast, but if you're leaving home, breakfast is critical, and then you come home and have another meal in the evening, and that's it.
Yeah.
There's no reason to eat more than that. Of course, you can snack, but then it's got to be high-fat snacks and high-protein snacks because they will take away your hunger very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. So you have to take those with you because you can't look around for them because they're not in the environment.
Yeah.
As soon as you look, I've just come back from the United States. We went for a keto conference in Ohio State University with Jeff Olick had organized it. And I'm amazed at the food, the availability, and it's all sugar driven. You go past the the chemists and all the bookshops, they're selling all this other rubbish.
Yeah.
And it is just sugar in your face all the time. You can't reverse the obesity epidemic until you get that out of the people's face. They're just exposed to it 24 hours a day.
Yeah, it's very difficult. And, you know, with children, you know, once they get, you know, my children are an age now where they have, you know, they do babysitting jobs and have their own money. And it's, you know, I watch them. That's what they spend their money on. If they can go and get chips and chocolate and treats, it's, you know, it's just so appealing and so addictive.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so difficult to break that.
Yeah.
And it's almost, you know, you have to get sick like I did and got my diabetes from following this guidelines. I want to make that point as we talk, that diabetes, which is the ultimate problem caused by this diet, is a disease of choice. I chose to eat that way and I got the disease. Yeah. My fault, not blaming anyone else. I'm not the victim. I made those choices. Yeah. And we really have to tell people that that's the choice. And if you're going to go that route of eating this bad food, this is the outcome.
Yeah.
But worse, you live such a lousy life because you're tired and then you get sick and you accept that as normal. Then you go to the doctor and you get medications which don't work. Yeah. And no one ever tells you, actually, just change your diet and you'll revolutionize your condition.
Yeah. Professor Noakes, can you cure type 2 diabetes or just control it?
That's a great question. And I think it's really important. The words we use are important because what we have to teach people is that it is a reversible condition.
Yeah.
And that's crucial. So if the word cure will encourage them to follow it, then it's important maybe to use that. But biologically, you're not cured.
Okay.
Because as soon as you slip back and eat a high carbohydrate diet, it comes back again.
Yeah.
So I'm really proud because I reversed. I call it reversing or in remission.
Yeah.
I put my diabetes in remission. It took me 7 years of eating 25 grams of carbohydrate a day and running and doing all sorts of other things. But it took 7 years.
Wow.
And now my glucose this morning was 4.9, which is below normal. Normal would be 5 or higher.
Yeah.
So I don't always get it every morning at 4.9, but today was, so that's great. Because my emotion is the most important determinant of what my fasting glucose is. And if I'm a bit emotional, stressed, my glucose will rise a bit to 5.5 or 5.6, which is still completely normal for my age. So if you were to test me, you wouldn't be able to tell that I'm diabetic.
Yeah.
But if you were to give me carbohydrates for 3 days, you'd see I'd be full-blown diabetic again. Yeah. And I think that's the key.
Okay.
So I like to say I'm in remission. I like to think I've cured the condition, but I understand that you can't go back. This is for life.
Yeah, okay.
But again, the message is type 2 diabetes is a disease of choice. You choose it by what you eat, and you can reverse it by choosing the right things. And, you know, there's a lot of interest in type 1 diabetes, that if you catch type 1 diabetes and you put people on a high-fat diet, the moment they're diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, you can have a much better outcome.
Okay.
But that needs to be proven. I don't want to give people that hope.
Yeah.
But it's very clear to me that we treat type 1 diabetes completely wrong. We give them this high-carbohydrate diet. That's not going to help.
Yeah.
We're not saying a high-fat diet's going to cure the type 1 diabetes, but it's going to make it much easier to manage. And maybe for some people, it will... Maybe they won't need to use as much insulin as a result.
Mm. I just, before I forget, we talked about intermittent fasting for we grown-ups, and we briefly touched on children. You're saying not so much for the children. So can you just go back to that? Because I know, you know, all mums listening are going to be wanting to have that guideline.
Well, I think that I wouldn't like children to be eating less than 2 meals a day. I think because they need more calories and they're probably pretty active, so they need a few more calories there. I don't think if the child is of a normal weight, there's no need to restrict calories. That's the key.
Mm.
If they're obese, then intermittent fasting it becomes important, because I think you must address obesity in children early, because and not get it fixed. and also that their self-esteem will rise. I've had so many reports of young women who have lost weight and it's completely changed their lives. And from the age of 13, 14, 15, they're aware that they're different. And so we have to help them. Yeah. And the key is we know what to do. And again, that you've got to just convince the child, this is the choice. You know, you can be fatter and eat these foods, or you can be thin and eat these foods. What do you choose?
I don't know what the statistics are in South Africa at the moment, but in Australia, I think they're saying by the year 2020, 8 in 10 children leaving school are going to be 80% overweight or obese. That's pretty scary.
No, that's right. I mean, then that becomes the norm. And
and
I think that's why I'm so fortunate, because I grew up in an era when everyone was lean. And so we have a standard which is different. But today people, and what the standard is 10 kilograms heavier than what we used to think was normal. And the next generation, it will be 15 kilograms heavier or whatever. Because I think a very important point for mothers is obesity begins in the pregnancy, during the pregnancy. That's terribly important. It's what the mother eats that determines the outcome for the child. And the more carbohydrates she eats, the more insulin she secretes, the more glucose she provides to the baby, to the fetus. And the fetus has to secrete insulin, because if the mother's insulin doesn't cross the placenta. So the fetus, every time the mother eats carbohydrate and her glucose spikes, she exposes the baby, the fetus, to a high glucose. And the baby has to secrete insulin. And so it produces its own insulin. It becomes insulin resistant already in the uterus. And so when it's born, what happens? We wean it onto high carbohydrate diets. So the insulin resistance just gets worse. And that's and then there are epigenetic effects, where what the mother ate influences the gene expression in the fetus and the baby to become fatter and more insulin resistant. So every generation's getting worse.
I actually heard that it's, is that correct, that it's actually three generations? So every woman carries three generations in that genetic makeup. So what my grandmother ate is actually playing a role in my health now.
Absolutely correct, And now I read a paper this morning, yesterday, again, it's the males as well. The male protein intake is influencing the sperm quality, and that's influencing what happens to the baby as well. So, yeah, there's all these effects which we're only beginning to start to realize now.
And that's where we're hearing the first, we're looking at the first generation that's going to have a shorter life expectancy than their parents.
And people don't understand that. And despite, in the United States, I don't know what it's like in Australia, but you've got this huge cost, increase in costs of medical costs, and the life expectancy is dropping. And I mean, so therefore, people have to understand, you can't buy health. You can't medicate health. Once you're sick, the doctors can't help you. The medication they're prescribing aren't going to help. And we have to stop. And we've got to understand that we're accountable for our health. And it's what we're eating is the single most important determinant. And what exercise we're doing is the second most important. And then we've got sleep and stress and all those other things.
But it's all, there's no magic pills. I actually love that that's the solution. I love that it is so straightforward. And, you know, that's what this series is all about, because I feel like we've grown up in a time where we've outsourced our health to experts, and they've, in a lot of instances, let us down. And now I think as adults, as mums who are raising this next generation, we are enormously empowered, because all this information now is just, you just have to hop on your computer, and there's so much stuff now that we can, but we've got to cut through some of that confusion.
Exactly. You know, I worked with a very famous coach, and he said, you know, there was sport before video analysis and after video analysis. Coaching did change. The moment video analysis came in, coaching changed. And it's the same with the internet and social media. They've completely changed medicine. There was medicine before the social media, and there's medicine afterwards. And unless doctors understand it, they're just going to become irrelevant. We're going to be getting all our medical care on the internet in future. And it's literally 5 years away. That we're not going to be going to doctors to get information.
I think education across the board is looking like that, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a good point. Very good point.
Fantastic. Professor Noakes, I feel very sad that I have to wind this up. I would love to just keep talking, but I know that you have an offer for our audience, a webinar program that you run. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, what we realized about 6 months ago, that I have a foundation and all the money I raise from talks like this or whatever, and the books I write and so on, I give to the foundation. And we realized that there were a couple of things we had to do. One was to fund research into we had to fund studies of low carbohydrate diets and help with the science there. Then we realized that the real problem in South Africa is the poorer people. They're eating the worst foods and they're the most sick. And we have to provide foods that are affordable but healthy. And so we have an Eat Better South Africa campaign. And then we realized that every doctor who converts to this diet changes tens of thousands of people's lives, because then they become advocates. So we said, we've got to target the medical profession. And we've developed the Nutrition Network, which is a platform to educate doctors on how to prescribe the low carbohydrate diet. And we have webinars and other lectures on our website. And so that's what we'd like to offer people, the participation in that program.
Lovely. I'll put a link to it under this so it's easy for people to get to and to find. So thank you so much for this interview. And I know that there's going to be lots of people that will seek out more information from you and your wonderful books. And their links to all your books and everything are on the Noakes Foundation website. Is that?
That's correct. And also there are links to the information I provided in my trial. There are 82 videos of each about 10 to 15 minutes taken from the trial and the evidence we gave. It's one of the most complete sets of evidence why the low carbohydrate diet is beneficial and why the high carbohydrate diet has caused all the problems.
Yeah.
We put it all in one place. It was 5.5 days testimony in court. Yeah, and 3.5 days cross-examination. So it was 9 days testimony. Gosh. But it's a unique experience, and it's never happened in science before that when someone is charged for giving an opinion that people didn't like, and then we said, well, okay, we'll show you. We'll show you what the evidence is.
Yeah.
So it is all in one place. It's a bit dry, but there's the evidence with all the hard science.
That's an amazing resource for those of us that are so passionate about it. It's fantastic. I just imagine that every day you must wake up with this enormous weight. It's just, oh, I can't even imagine. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah. Thank you, Edwina. It's been a privilege to speak to you. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye for now.
Thanks. Bye-bye.